Hey, Columbus, it's Jenny and Bill from Simple Bath & Kitchen. Are you thinking about updating your bathroom or kitchen?
Don't call some big out-of-town franchise. We're local, top to bottom, right here in Columbus.
We know our city, we know the homes, and we always treat every project like it's our own.
On time, on budget, zero pressure, so you can actually enjoy your home.
Visit SimpleBathAndKitchen.com today.
We make it simple for you.
That's SimpleBathAndKitchen.com.
SimpleBathAndKitchen.com.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. This is the place we go to get you completely fluent in the history, the doctrine, and the big strategic shifts that are shaping our world.
And today, we're taking on a really big one.
A huge one. Today, we're digging into one of the most storied, self-defining, and you could argue most adaptable military organizations on the planet, the United States Marine Corps.
It's a massive topic because fundamentally the USMC is a study in contradiction.
How so?
Well, think about it. They're the smallest of the armed services under the Department of the Navy, but they operate as a complete, you know, integrated, combined arms force all by themselves.
Right. They have their own air force, their own artillery, their own logistics. It's all designed for a single purpose.
Exactly. Small, focused, and totally self-sufficient when they deploy.
And our source stack today is incredibly comprehensive. We're covering the Corps' nearly 250-year history.
Yep. Plus their unique MBTF structure, the famous battles that really forged their identity.
And the really dramatic, forward-looking, strategic shift that's happening right now with Force Design 2030.
So our mission today is to give you the clearest, fastest path to understanding not just what the Marines do, but more importantly, why they're structured the way they are.
And why they've had to fight so hard so many times for their own institutional survival.
So to set the baseline, let's talk about their core duality. Legally, the USMC is the Maritime Land Force Service Branch.
Meaning they're known specifically for expeditionary operations, projecting power from the sea onto the shore.
But here's the kicker, and this is what really creates their identity. Unlike, say, the Army, which relies on the Air Force for strategic airlift and air support.
Or the Navy, which needs the Army for any kind of sustained land combat.
Right. The Marines possess their own organic combined arms capabilities. The infantry, the artillery, the air support, both fixed wing and helicopters, and even their own special operations forces are all integrated from the ground up.
They bring the whole package.
The whole package, ready to go.
And their mission, this is important, is congressionally mandated. It's under Title 10 of the U.S. Code, Section 5063, and it lays out three primary areas of responsibility.
The first one is highly specific. It's the seizure or defense of advanced naval bases and conducting any land operations that are, you know, essential to supporting a naval campaign.
Everything ties back to the Navy.
Always. The second is more institutional. They have the statutory job of developing the tactics, the techniques, and the equipment for amphibious landing forces.
And they do that in coordination with the Army and the Air Force, right?
Yes. It ensures that if a massive joint landing is ever needed, the Marines are still the undisputed experts in how to do it.
And then there's the third clause. This is, I think, arguably the most famous and strategically flexible mandate in the entire American armed services.
It's the key to everything.
It's simply, such other duties as the president or Department of Defense may direct, we should just call it the flexibility clause.
That flexibility clause is absolutely crucial. It has defined nearly every major operation the Marines have conducted outside of, you know, traditional naval support.
From the very beginning on the Barbary Coast.
To their involvement in the Banana Wars, right up to very recent, very high profile domestic deployments. It ensures their operational flexibility is perpetually guaranteed.
Which, as we'll see, has often been to the institutional chagrin of the other services.
Oh, absolutely.
So before we jump into that history, let's get a quick organizational snapshot. The Marines trace their roots back to the Continental Marines.
Founded on November 10th, 1775. And that date is their official birthday, a tradition celebrated all over the world.
They were later reestablished in their current form on July 11, 1798.
And remember that institutional tie. They are absolutely inseparable from the Department of the Navy. That relationship has been legally cemented since 1834.
And in terms of size, they're a focused mid-sized force. As of late 2024, they're operating with approximately 168,527 active personnel.
And about 33,000 in reserve. Small enough to be agile, but large enough to make a very big difference.
Okay, let's unpack this evolution. Because when the Continental Marines were formed in 1775, they were not thinking about taking on the Japanese Empire on Pacific Islands.
No, not at all. Their original mission was very specific and very maritime.
They were founded primarily to serve as infantry units aboard naval vessels.
Right. Their responsibilities were things like ship security, which sounds simple, but you have to think about the context. They conducted offensive and defensive combat during boarding actions, fighting off privateers or enemy frigates.
But the truly fascinating part is their role in maintaining order on the ship.
Yes. They were positioned strategically to defend the ship's officers against a potential mutiny from the general crew.
I read that their quarters were often intentionally situated between the officer's space and the rest of the vessel.
Exactly. To serve as a physical barrier and a rapid reaction force if things went sideways at sea, they were, quite literally, the onboard police force.
And that foundational role expanded ashore almost immediately. We see that expeditionary capability in their very first action, which was a true amphibious assault.
The raid on Nassau in the Bahamas, March 3, 1776.
And it worked. They landed and successfully secured Fort Montague and Fort Nassau,
which was a critical British ammunition depot and naval port. So this wasn't a naval battle. This was a landing force seizing critical assets on shore.
That set the expeditionary tone right away, didn't it? They were a naval asset that fought on land.
And that mission has only expanded, thanks in large part to that third statutory point we mentioned.
The other duties clause.
The enduring other duties clause. The earliest examples of this expeditionary nature are found right in the Revolutionary War, far from any ship.
For instance, their first land combat engagement wasn't near a port at all. It was attached to the Continental Army at the Battle of Princeton in January 1777.
That's right. George Washington, who was in retreat after crossing the Delaware, needed disciplined, veteran soldiers for a flanking attack.
So he ordered Major Samuel Nicholas and the available Marines to attach themselves to General Cadwalader's brigade.
An estimated 130 Marines were there. It was a small number, but their inclusion showed that Congress and Washington viewed them as highly reliable infantry.
A flexible force that could be deployed wherever needed, even supporting the main army formations way inland.
But the first major action that truly immortalized the Corps, the one that gave them a permanent place in the national consciousness, was the First Barbary War.
Between 1801 and 1805, we are, of course, talking about the shores of Tripoli.
The sources detailed this incredible expedition led by First Lieutenant Presley O'Bannon. He marched a mixed force of Marines, Greek mercenaries, and local allies.
Over 500 miles across the desert from Egypt to the city of Derna.
Right. And though the Navy provided support from the sea, the ultimate success in taking Derna was instrumental in ending the war and securing the release of American prisoners held by the Pasha of Tripoli.
The cultural impact of that march is just impossible to overstate. It's why the Marines' hymn begins with, "From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli."
And it's why Marine officers today carry the Mameluke sword. It was presented to Lieutenant O'Bannon by the Ottoman Empire's prince, Hamid Karamanli, as a sign of respect for his bravery.
And that sword is the single oldest continuously carried military award in the United States.
Amazing. Later, during the War of 1812, their reputation grew not just for fighting ashore, but as expert marksmen aboard ships.
They played a decisive role, for example, holding the center of General Andrew Jackson's defensive line at the Battle of New Orleans in 1815.
By then, they had gained a reputation for skill in both defensive and ship-to-ship actions during the many frigate duels of that war.
So this brings us to the 20th century and the codification of their role. As naval warfare changed, the need for small detachments on ships declined.
So the Corps adapted by focusing entirely on those secondary missions ashore. They transitioned from being security guards on the ship to an offensive force launched from the ship.
And this is where that shift really crystallized, in the development of the advanced base doctrine in the early 20th century.
This doctrine outlined the systematic use of Marines for seizing forward bases, coaling stations, supply depots, harbors, to support the Navy's fleet operations around the globe.
And that concept became absolutely central to the entire island-hopping strategy of World War II. It defined their purpose for decades.
But this is where the institutional tension really bubbles up. The sources remind us of the friction surrounding the Corps' political existence. After WWII, President Harry Truman famously or infamously dismissed them.
The 1950 letter, he called the Marine Corps the Navy's police force and said their propaganda machine was almost equal to Stalin's.
A phenomenal political blunder, regardless of his policy views. The backlash was explosive. Congressmen, veterans organizations, they all demanded an apology.
Truman did apologize, but only for his harsh language, right?
Exactly. He apologized for mentioning Stalin, but he pointedly did not change his official position that the Corps was an unnecessary duplication of land power and should report strictly to the Navy Secretary.
So that friction over their mission scope, are they a specialized naval extension or just a second army? It's a constant theme in their history.
And that institutional threat forces the Corps to continually double down on what makes them essential, which is their unique organizational blueprint.
Which brings us to the concept of rapid deployment and combined arms.
Precisely. They may not have any capabilities that are totally unique to them. The Army has infantry, the Navy has planes, but their strength lies in integrating all those elements and deploying them incredibly fast.
We're talking about the Marine Air Ground Task Force, or MGTF.
The MGTF. It's the basic, flexible structure for all deployed Marine units, and it ensures the permanent integration of ground, air, and logistics under a single command.
This self-sufficiency is absolutely critical for an expeditionary force that can't just wait around for other services to assemble all the different pieces.
And this whole organizational culture centers entirely on the infantry mission. Every other capability the Marines have exists solely to support the ground forces.
And that's the origin of that defining concept, every Marine a rifleman.
It's a cultural statement, championed by Commandant Alfred M. Gray, Jr. It means that all Marines, whether they're pilots or finance officers or logistics specialists, receive rigorous infantry training.
And all officers, no matter what their final job is, get additional training as infantry platoon commanders.
The goal isn't just cross-training. It's cultural cohesion. It ensures the entire organization stays focused on the combat mission and that non-combat specialists understand the needs and the doctrine of the Marines fighting on the ground.
Our sources have a perfect anecdote for this from the Battle of Wake Island during WWII.
Right. When Japanese airstrikes destroyed all the Marine aircraft on the island, the pilots didn't just sit out the fight.
They immediately reported to the ground commander and continued the defense as infantry officers. They were leading formations made up of cooks and supply clerks in the final defensive efforts.
That embodies every Marine a rifleman.
Their doctrine is built on speed and flexibility. They were one of the earliest branches to widely adopt maneuver warfare principles.
It's the season of gratitude. We love this time of year because it helps us to actually take the time to focus on all that we truly have and all that we're thankful for.
At Simple Bath & Kitchen, all of you pop to the top of that list. Our Columbus community has allowed our SB&K team to work in your most sacred place, your home.
We understand that privilege, and we're so happy that by remodeling your bathroom and your kitchen, you've become part of our family.
At Simple Bath & Kitchen, we're grateful for you.
Which shifts the focus from just massing power to actually outmaneuvering the enemy. It emphasizes low-level initiative, speed, and what's called the commander's intent.
Meaning, you define the end goal, but you leave the how open to the units on the ground to figure out.
Exactly. And this evolved from the amphibious assault techniques of WWII into their current primary doctrine, operational maneuver from the sea, or OMFTS.
This is a crucial concept. Traditional amphibious landings, like Iwo Jima, were characterized by this massive buildup of forces right off the shore,
which often resulted in horrific casualties as troops crossed the beach under fire.
OMFTS is radically different. It emphasizes landing forces from way beyond the visible horizon, making that traditional beachhead phase less dangerous.
It relies heavily on high-speed connectors, like the El Soleil air cushion landing craft and organic aviation like the MV-22 Osprey.
So they can rapidly bypass enemy defenses and put forces directly onto key objectives deep inland.
Essentially, turning the sea into a maneuver space, not just a staging area.
And that whole concept relies absolutely on the Navy. The Marine Corps depends entirely on the Navy for sea lift. They don't own any of those big transport ships.
To ensure they can deploy rapidly, Marine Expeditionary Units, or MEUs, are typically stationed at sea aboard amphibious assault ships, ready to be the nation's first responders.
And they also use the maritime pre-positioning system,
which involves fleets of container ships prepositioned all over the globe. These ships have enough equipment, water, fuel, and supplies to support an entire Marine Expeditionary Force for 30 days without any resupply.
They truly are two integrated parts of one naval service.
Absolutely.
Okay, moving into the historical timeline, the Corps faced an existential threat surprisingly early on, right after the War of 1812. And it wasn't just Truman who wanted them gone.
That's right. President Andrew Jackson tried to combine and integrate the Corps directly into the Army. He just saw them as redundant.
So who saved them?
It was Commandant Archibald Henderson, who served from 1820 to 1859. I mean, a truly monumental tenure. He's credited with thwarting Jackson's effort.
How did he pull it off?
Henderson was a shrewd politician. He mobilized public opinion and, more importantly, congressional support. His efforts secured the Corps' continued existence.
And that resulted in Congress passing the Act for the Better Organization of the Marine Corps in 1834.
A landmark act. It legally stipulated the Corps as a distinct, separate service under the Department of the Navy, explicitly preserving their identity and mission from the Army's control.
Just over a decade later, we get the action that anchors the second half of the Marines' hymn, the Mexican-American War and the famed assault on Chapultepec Palace.
The Halls of Montezuma.
Exactly. This was a decisive action during the Battle of Mexico City in 1847. The palace was a military academy on top of a highly fortified hill.
The assault was fierce, and Marine participation led by Major Levi Twiggs was instrumental in capturing the objective. The flag raising there became a major political and propaganda victory for the United States.
Although we do have to pause for a moment on the historical detail our sources provide. While the Marines participated bravely, most of the troops making that final assault were actually Army soldiers.
Right, from the 9th and 11th Infantry. The entire American force organized two storming parties of about 250 men each, and only about 40 of those were Marines.
So the enduring legend is maybe more significant than the specific troop count.
That's a powerful point. It's a great example of how the Marine identity, that image of the hard-fighting, first-to-the-fight force, sometimes supersedes the granular historical reality, which then reinforces their culture.
Shifting to the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the Corps really embraced its expeditionary nature between the major conflicts. They became the go-to force for foreign interventions.
Between 1899 and 1916, they were involved in over 28 separate interventions in 30 years, constantly stepping in to protect American interests overseas.
These actions in China for the Boxer Rebellion, in Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, the so-called Banana Wars, were crucial for developing their doctrine.
Absolutely. The experience they gained in these protracted counterinsurgency and guerrilla operations was later consolidated into the famous Small Wars Manual.
Which wasn't just a historical document, it became the framework for Marine counterinsurgency for decades.
Elements were used in Vietnam, and surprisingly, it was still being referenced during the campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan.
World War I brought a massive change in scale and validation for the Corps. When America entered in 1917, the Corps expanded dramatically.
From about 13,000 personnel to 70,000 enlisted and 2,400 officers by the end of the war. They served with distinction as part of the American Expeditionary Force under General Pershing.
And this is where the enduring nickname, Devil Dogs, or Teufelhunding, comes from.
The legend holds that German soldiers nicknamed them this, literally devil dogs, for their ferocious reputation as shock troops and marksmen during the intense fighting at the Battle of Belleau Wood in 1918.
But here's a fascinating counterfact from our sources. The USMC History Division suggests the term Teufelhunding was likely an invention of an American war correspondent.
And it may have appeared in print 6 weeks before the fighting at Belleau Wood had even concluded.
So if the historical origin is debatable, why does that specific legend persist so powerfully in Marine culture?
I think it's because it perfectly encapsulates the image they want to project, an enemy-bestowed title of fear and respect. Regardless of the exact origin, the nickname stuck and became an integral part of their cultural DNA.
And on a related note, WWI also marked another big institutional moment.
Ulfa Mae Johnson. She enlisted in 1918, becoming the first woman Marine.
She served in a clerical role, right? To free up a male Marine for service overseas.
That's right. Fast forward to World War II. This is where the Corps' newly developed amphibious doctrine defined the entire Pacific campaign.
The sheer scope of their involvement in island hopping Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Saipan, Iwo Jima, Okinawa, it made them indispensable.
The cost was staggering. WWII was the Corps' defining moment. It resulted in nearly 87,000 casualties, and Marines earned 82 Medals of Honor.
And the image of the flag raising at Iwo Jima became the lasting symbol of American resolve and Marine sacrifice.
And yet, after this incredible high point, the Corps immediately faced another institutional crisis. The military budget shrank dramatically.
And the newly established Department of Defense, led by influential Army officers like Eisenhower and Marshall, tried once again to dismantle the Corps entirely.
They saw its mission as redundant or just too expensive.
It was Secretary of the Navy James Forrestal who predicted, upon seeing the Iwo Jima photo, that the raising of that flag on Suribachi means a Marine Corps for the next 500 years.
That quote, combined with intense lobbying by veterans groups and a hastily assembled congressional support, a movement often called the Revolt of the Admirals, led directly to the statutory protection of the Marine Corps.
This was cemented in the National Security Act of 1947, which defined their specific mission.
And then, even more critically, the Douglas-Mansfield Act of 1952. That act gave the Commandant of the Marine Corps an equal voice with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on matters relating to the Marines.
It ensured their institutional existence was legally ironclad and that they could advocate for themselves at the highest strategic level.
And that political victory was tested almost immediately with the Korean War, starting in 1950.
Our sources highlight the hasty formation of the Provisional Marine Brigade, which held the defensive line at the Pusan perimeter when U.S. forces were on the brink of collapse.
But the critical moment was the amphibious landing at Incheon. General MacArthur's plan was audacious. It was risky. A surprise landing deep behind enemy lines in a harbor known for extreme tides.
And the Marines spearheaded that landing using their WWII-honed expertise. It led to the collapse of the North Korean lines and the recapture of Seoul.
That operational success, however, was immediately followed by one of the Corps' most iconic feats of resilience, the fighting withdrawal of the 1st Marine Division at the Battle of Chosin Reservoir.
An epic test of will. The Marines, under Major General Oliver P. Smith, found themselves deep in North Korea, suddenly surrounded and outnumbered by a surprise entrance of vast numbers of Chinese forces.
November 1950, and they were facing temperatures plunging to 20 degrees below zero. They had to fight their way 78 miles to the coast.
Smith's famous quote really encapsulates their spirit when retreat was ordered. He said, "We are not retreating. We are advancing in another direction."
And the 1st Marine Division successfully broke out, bringing their equipment, most of their wounded, and even their dead with them to the port of Hungnam for evacuation. It's a testament to that cultural emphasis on never leaving a man behind.
The Corps expanded to 261,000 Marines during the war, mostly reservists, and suffered over 30,000 casualties. It really cemented their image as a force that could endure and fight even when strategically encircled.
Then the Vietnam era. This represented the longest conflict for the Marines up to that time. They operated primarily in the Northern I Corps regions of South Vietnam.
Constantly fighting a complex dual war conventional battles against the North Vietnamese Army and a persistent guerrilla war against the Viet Cong.
Their unique approach included the less known Combined Action Program, or CAP, and it proved to be one of the more successful models of counterinsurgency used during the war.
CAP integrated small units of Marines with local South Vietnamese militias. They lived and fought among the local population to provide security and win hearts and minds at the village level.
But this long, grinding war in a complex political landscape resulted in massive casualties. Over 13,000 Marines killed in action.
Moving into the interim years before the global war on terrorism, we see the high-profile and tragic Beirut barracks bombing in 1983.
A suicide bomber drove a truck laden with explosives into the headquarters of the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. This resulted in the highest peacetime loss in Corps history, 220 Marines and 21 other service members killed.
After Beirut, they resumed their expeditionary roles, notably in Operation Desert Storm in 1990 and 91.
The I-Marine Expeditionary Force successfully executed the largest and fastest amphibious landing feint in history. They convinced the Iraqis they would land from the sea.
Well, instead, Marine task forces liberated Kuwait from the ground alongside coalition forces.
They also conducted combat operations during the Somali Civil War intervention in the mid-90s.
Then came the global war on terrorism. Marines were among the very first conventional forces deployed to Afghanistan in support of Operation Enduring Freedom.
November 2001, specifically elements of the 15th and 26th MEUs.
Their commitment intensified, particularly in the notoriously violent Helmand province. Large-scale operations included the Battle of Marja in 2010.
Which at the time was the largest offensive of the Afghan campaign since 2001, focused on clearing a key Taliban stronghold. Marines remained in Helmand until large-scale combat operations ended in 2014.
And in Iraq, the I-Marine Expeditionary Force spearheaded the 2003 invasion alongside the army.
They were later responsible for the intense fighting in Al-Anbar province, which included the two brutal battles of Fallujah in 2004.
Apartment People, champion, the trusted name in Columbus Living, brings you the District of Berkshire.
Man, it would be fun to live there, right by Tanger Outlet Malls. Oh my God, great location too, getting to and from Columbus, and a great deal right now.
Free rent until next year. Free rent until next year.
He ain't lying. Move in now. You don't pay rent until next year.
The District at Berkshire. Available now at livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com.
The first Battle of Fallujah Operation Vigilant Resolve was partially aborted due to political concerns. The second battle, Operation Phantom Fury, was one of the bloodiest urban combat operations the U.S. military had faced since Hue in Vietnam.
It really showed the core adaptation to sustained, company-level urban warfare, a far cry from their original expeditionary landing mission.
But their time in El Anbar was fraught with moral and institutional challenges. This included high-profile, devastating incidents like the Haditha killings and the Hamdania incident,
which our sources note courted significant criticism and resulted in courts-martial.
Those incidents created a lot of institutional soul-searching, didn't they?
They did. They forced the Corps to grapple with the ethical and operational strains placed on forces maintaining long deployments in such a volatile environment. The Marines officially ended their primary role in Iraq in 2010.
And this is where we hit the most crucial modern shift, the pivot to the China threat, the Indo-Pacific.
By the 2020s, as U.S. national strategy shifted away from ground-centric counterinsurgency, the Marine Corps realized it needed to abandon its previous heavyweight configuration.
That Second Army concern that Secretary Robert Gates worried about years earlier.
Right. And this is a monumental strategic overhaul called Force Design 2030. The Corps is now strengthening its configuration specifically for sea control and sea denial in the Indo-Pacific.
Preparing for possible island operations against a technologically advanced foe like the Chinese People's Liberation Army.
And this pivot involves fundamental changes. The total divestment of heavy equipment, which we'll get into, and the adoption of new concepts like Expeditionary Advanced Base Operations, or EABO.
EABO. The strategy envisions small, highly mobile, and lethal marine units rapidly seizing and fortifying remote islands.
Within the enemy's anti-accessoria denial bubble, essentially turning small islands into forward missile batteries to disrupt enemy naval movements.
This strategic shift has also solidified joint deployment efforts, notably with Australia. They established a joint deployment in Darwin with a rotational presence of Marines that began back in 2011.
And that positioning is critical for maintaining presence and readiness in the Southern Pacific theater.
Okay, moving now to organization. Let's nail down where the Corps sits institutionally, starting at the top. As we established, they're under the Department of the Navy.
Led by the Secretary of the Navy, who reports up to the Secretary of Defense.
The Corps' internal leadership is defined by the Commandant, who holds the rank of a four-star general.
He's the highest-ranking officer, unless a Marine happens to be serving as the chairman or vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And critically, the Commandant holds the Title 10 responsibility to staff, train, and equip the Corps.
And he's a full member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, reporting directly to the Secretary of the Navy.
Exactly. Supporting him is the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps, the senior enlisted Marine, who acts as the primary advisor to the Commandant on all matters of morale and welfare for the enlisted force.
Headquarters Marine Corps, or HQMC, also oversees Marine Corps Aviation and Marine Corps Intelligence.
The operating forces are the deployed personnel. These are divided into Marine Corps Forces, or MARFWARS, which are assigned to regional combatant commands like CNTCOM or PACOM.
You also have security forces guarding high-risk naval installations and Marine Security Guard detachments at American embassies worldwide.
That's a high-profile mission they've held since 1947.
The MARFWARS are split geographically into Forces Command, or MARFORCOM,
which oversees 2TBF on the East Coast.
And Pacific Command, MARFORPAC, which oversees IPF on the West Coast, and 3rd APLF in Japan and Hawaii.
And reflecting the modern global mission, there are additional component commands tailored for specific domains. MARFORCENT for the Middle East, MARFOR-URAF for Europe and Africa.
And even specialized commands like MARFOR-CYBER and MARFOR-SPACE, integrating Marines into the cyber and orbital domains.
And all of these forces hinge on that foundational concept of the MAGTF, the Marine Air Ground Task Force.
This is the fundamental, flexible, and deployable unit for the Corps, embodying their preference for self-sufficiency and combined arms.
Every deployed Marine unit, no matter the size, is constructed using 4 permanently integrated elements. This ensures the force is never deployed without all its necessary components.
First, you have the command element, the CE, the headquarters unit, providing command, control, intelligence, communications.
Second is the ground combat element, or GCE. This is the infantry, artillery, engineers, and until recently, armor, the main fighting body.
Third is the aviation combat element, the ACE, which provides organic fixed wing and rotary wing support, close air support, air defense, air transport.
The ACE is what allows the Corps to operate independently of the Air Force.
And finally, the logistics combat element, LCE, providing immediate combat service support, resupply, maintenance, engineering, medical aid.
And the beauty of the NGTF is its scalability. It comes in four standardized sizes.
The smallest is the MEU, the Marine Expeditionary Unit. About 2,200 Marines capable of 15 days of sustained operations, often deployed at sea.
Then you have the MEB, the Marine Expeditionary Brigade, about 14,500 Marines capable of 30 days.
And the largest is the MEF, the Marine Expeditionary Force. Over 40,000 Marines capable of 60 days of operations. That's what spearheaded the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
And finally, the SPM AGTF, or Special Purpose MGTF. It's tailored for specific missions like crisis response or embassy security, using only the necessary elements. This structured, predictable scalability allows planners to deploy the exact right size of force immediately.
Now, let's address special operations. The Marines have a very unique and relatively new relationship with U.S. Special Operations Command, or USSOCOM.
The establishment of Marine Forces Special Operations Command, MARSOC, faced substantial historical resistance.
Back when USSOCOM was founded in the 80s, the commandant at the time, General Paul Kelly, firmly believed the Corps shouldn't fund a special ops capability that wouldn't directly support Marine-only operations.
His argument was doctrinal. Marines should only support Marines, and the entire Corps should already be expeditionary and highly capable.
That's fascinating. So for almost two decades, the Marines were the only branch not fully integrated into USSOCOM. What was the catalyst that changed this entrenched belief?
The sources indicate the tipping point came during the very early stages of Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan.
Marine leaders watched the Corps' existing special operations capable units, the 15th and 26th MUSOCs, find themselves sitting on the sidelines. Because USSOCOM, which controlled the highest priority missions, preferred to use its dedicated components, Delta Force, SEALs, Army Special Forces.
Components that were immediately deployable under SOCOM's specific command structure. The MEU-SOCs, while capable, were bound by conventional Navy Marine command structures, meaning they couldn't be easily tasked for those high-value missions.
So seeing those high-level assets unused while the war was active spurred the change.
Precisely. After 3 years of intense policy debate, the Corps agreed in 2006 to supply a 2,500-strong component directly to USSOCOM, which became MARSOC.
And this unit was later named the Marine Raiders, honoring the WWII Marine Raider Battalions.
MARSOC is organized around the Marine Raider Regiment, which executes direct action and special reconnaissance, the Marine Raider Support Group for logistics and intel, and the Marine Raider Training Center, which runs the intensive selection program.
It is important to note the distinction here, though. MARSOC Raiders are the dedicated special operations component.
But the conventional reconnaissance units, force reconnaissance companies and reconnaissance battalions, share many tactics and equipment. But they remain conventional forces. Force Recon reports to the conventional MEF, or division commander, to support the MEDGTF, not necessarily USSOCOM.
Got it. Okay, culture is what truly sets the Marine Corps apart. It reinforces camaraderie and a deep esprit de corps. Their identity is arguably the strongest among the U.S. services, rooted deeply in history.
That identity is instantly recognizable in their emblems. The Eagle, Globe, and Anchor, or EGA, was adopted in 1868.
And each piece symbolizes their heritage, right? The Eagle represents the nation.
The Globe represents their worldwide service and expeditionary reach. And the Anchor connects them directly to their naval origins.
Their colors are scarlet and gold, and their motto is the Latin Semper Fidelis.
Always faithful. Often shortened, of course, to Semper Fi.
The Corps also has deep musical traditions. The Marines hymn is officially the oldest official song in the U.S. Armed Forces from the mid-19th century.
And the official march of the Corps, Semper Fi, was composed by none other than John Philip Sousa, who served as a Marine apprentice and later led the prestigious United States Marine Band.
Their ceremonial practices reinforce that distinct history and commitment to discipline.
Close order drill is heavily emphasized in initial training, not just for parades, but specifically to instill instantaneous discipline, unit cohesion, and precision under stress.
And of course, the Marine Corps birthday celebration on November 10th is a global tradition. It features a formal ball, a reading of the Commandant's birthday message,
and the symbolic cake-cutting ceremony. The first slice goes to the oldest Marine present, symbolizing the transfer of wisdom, who then passes it to the youngest Marine present, symbolizing the future of the Corps.
Now for the unofficial traditions, we already hit on devil dogs, then you have leatherneck.
Which references the high, stiff leather collar that was part of the uniform during the Revolutionary War period. It was originally designed to protect the neck from saber cuts.
Jarhead is also common, though the sources note it has a few disputed explanations.
It might reference the old utility cap and high stiff collar, which made a Marine's head look like a mason jar lid. Whatever the origin, it's an embraced self-deprecating term.
The common Marine rallying cry is "Ura,"
a high-energy vocalization used to express enthusiasm, agreement, or aggression.
And the unofficial mantra, which perfectly captures the expeditionary mindset, is "improvise, adapt, and overcome."
The sources describe this as reflecting the Corps' preference for being a fluid, loosely reined force that can spontaneously react to rapidly changing, ambiguous situations.
Which happens constantly when you are the first force on the ground in a crisis.
Exactly.
Shifting to training, which is foundational to this culture, Marine recruit training, or boot camp, is 13 weeks long, the longest among the American military services.
It's designed to strip away civilian tendencies and instill that Corps identity very quickly.
What's unique about officer accession is the institutional commitment to the rifleman concept. Regardless of where an officer comes from, the Naval Academy, NROTC, or Officer Candidate School, all new commissioned officers must attend the Basic School, or TBS, at Quantico.
And this is a critical 5 to 6 month course. It's where every Marine, a rifleman, gets reinforced.
At TBS, every commissioned officer, even those slated for careers in aviation or logistics, learns the art and science of infantry tactics and combined arms warfare.
They must first be capable ground commanders. It ensures that competence in combat leadership is absolutely central to their professional identity.
Let's briefly touch on the rank structure. It follows the three categories: commissioned, warrant, and enlisted. Within the enlisted ranks, there's a clear hierarchy defined by responsibility.
E1 through E3 are the entry ranks. The non-commissioned officers, or NCOs, are E4 corporals and E5 sergeants.
They're the direct supervisors of junior Marines, the vital link between the rank and file and the officers, the backbone of discipline.
Then you have the E6 and higher, the staff non-commissioned officers, or SNCOs, staff sergeants, gunnery sergeants, and so on. They supervise the NCOs and act as crucial enlisted advisors to the command staff.
The E8 and E9 pay grades introduce a specialized two-track billet system, which is distinctive.
The first sergeant and sergeant major ranks are command-oriented, focusing on discipline, administration, morale. In contrast, master sergeants and master gunnery sergeants provide technical leadership as occupational specialists.
So this two-track system ensures commands have both deep institutional and technical knowledge at the senior enlisted level.
Another defining aspect of Marine training is the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program, or MCME, which was initiated in 2001.
And this wasn't just about fighting. It was a doctrinal response to new operational realities emerging from peacekeeping missions.
Exactly. With the expectation that urban and police-type peacekeeping missions would become more common, placing Marines in close proximity to unarmed, potentially hostile civilians, the Corps needed a solution.
MCMA was implemented to give Marines a more versatile set of less-than-lethal options for controlling hostile individuals in those scenarios. It's designed to instill the warrior ethos, but with ethical scaling of force.
It's an eclectic mix of global styles. It incorporates grappling from jiu-jitsu, ground fighting from Brazilian jiu-jitsu, striking from Muay Thai, plus knife and stick fighting from Eskrima.
Marines earn belts from tan up to black, which they wear with their utility uniforms, signifying their proficiency level and moral discipline.
Finally, we have to discuss the Corps' challenging integration history. The Marine Corps was actually the last U.S. service to begin recruiting African Americans.
This only began in 1942 due to an executive order from President Franklin D. Roosevelt that forced the Corps, despite objections from its institutional leadership, to comply.
And they accepted African Americans into segregated all-black units. This training took place at Montford Point in North Carolina from 1942 to 1949. 20,000 African Americans were trained there during that period.
It was a separate, unequal process that reflected the prejudices of the time.
Montford Point was later renamed Camp Gilbert H. Johnson, honoring one of the first black Marines. But full racial integration across the service wasn't achieved until 1960.
The history of the Montford Point Marines is a painful but important reminder of the fight for equal service opportunity.
For women in the Corps, as we noted, Opha Mae Johnson was the first in 1918. After decades in non-combat support roles, a major milestone occurred in January 2017.
Following a DOD mandate opening all combat roles, three women successfully joined an infantry battalion at Camp Lejeune, the first time women had served as infantry Marines.
And the Corps also began a trial program in December 2020 to integrate females into the training companies at the previously all-male San Diego Recruit Depot.
Okay, let's talk about the relationship between the Marine Corps and the Navy. It's often referred to simply as the Naval Service.
And it's characterized by a deep, symbiotic, and utterly necessary interdependence.
It is absolute. The Navy is the force multiplier for the Marines. They provide the transportation, the logistical support, and combat support like carrier-based air cover and naval gunfire.
And most Marine aviation assets, including the F-35B, ultimately derive from the Navy in terms of acquisition, funding, and testing.
What's fascinating is how Navy personnel fill critical roles that the Marines do not recruit for themselves. The Corps doesn't recruit chaplains or medical and dental personnel.
That's right. Naval personnel, hospital corpsmen, religious program specialists, dental officers fill these roles. They serve as embedded members of Marine units.
You'll often see a Navy corpsman wearing a Marine uniform but with Navy insignia fighting right alongside Marines.
This reliance reinforces the team concept and allows the Marines to maintain their focus as a pure combat arms organization, relying on the Navy's infrastructure for support services.
And they share extensive joint training, too. Marine aviators are designated as naval aviators, and the Corps gets a significant portion of its officers from the Naval Academy and NROTC.
This close relationship is codified in the 2007 Tri-Service Strategy with the Navy and Coast Guard, a cooperative strategy for 21st century sea power. It focuses equally on preventing war through forward presence and conducting war when necessary.
Now let's move to the Army. This is where the historical friction and competition remain most acute.
As we discussed, the competition dates back to George Washington's refusal to allow the initial Continental Marines battalions to be drawn from his army.
And that friction culminated in the post-WWII attempts by Army leadership to dissolve the Corps entirely, while the Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986 enforced greater joint decision-making.
The mission overlap remains a source of institutional tension. DOD Directive 5100.01 tasks both the Army and the Marine Corps with expeditionary and amphibious operations.
But the key difference lies in force design and focus. The Army is massive and diverse, from very light infantry brigade combat teams to heavy armored BCTs.
The Marine Corps, by contrast, operates in the middle. They focus on integrated, self-sufficient, and smaller mid-range forces, perfect for rapid deployment and initial entry.
So the Army is built for strategic depth and sustained campaigns. The Marines are built for speed and forcing entry.
And the strategic implications of this difference came to a head in 2020 with a highly significant equipment shift. This is the central evidence of that force design 2030 pivot.
The Marine Corps made the decision to retire all of its M1A1 Abrams tanks and eliminate all of its dedicated tank units.
That is a massive divestment of conventional heavy capability. Why get rid of a proven platform like the Abrams?
Commandant David Berger described the Abrams as operationally unsuitable for our highest priority challenges, meaning the new focus on littoral operations against China, not land-centric counterinsurgency.
The math simply didn't work for the Pacific theater. The problem was logistical and geographical. The M1A1 is extremely heavy, limiting which amphibious ships could transport it.
And it requires specialized large-scale connectors like heavy-lift L6 that are slow and vulnerable in a high-intensity conflict zone.
Furthermore, the tank's operational range and weight made it unsuitable for EABO. The new strategy requires small, light, mobile forces that can hide and shoot.
So the divestment was part of a trade-off. By shedding the Abrams and much of its traditional towed artillery, the Corps is investing heavily in long-range precision fires and unmanned systems,
which leaves the Army as the sole American operator of tanks and underscores the Marines' return to their naval roots.
Turning to current equipment, this modern shift is visible everywhere. In individual weaponry, the M27 IAR is the new standard service rifle for infantry.
It's essentially a heavy-barrel, highly accurate rifle designed for automatic and semi-automatic use. And in 2021, the Corps committed to fielding suppressors to all its infantry units,
making them the first U.S. branch to adopt them widely. This reflects lessons learned about noise discipline, communication clarity, and reducing detection on the modern battlefield.
For amphibious vehicles, they're currently transitioning from the older tracked AAV-7A1, which was notoriously thin-skinned and dated, to the new amphibious combat vehicle, or ACV.
The ACV is an 8x8 wheeled vehicle that features superior armor protection against blasts and mines, and much greater speed and mobility once it hits the shore.
Aviation, of course, remains organic and essential. Key air power includes the MB-22 Osprey tilt rotor, which provides medium lift and is vital for operational maneuver from the sea because of its speed and vertical lift capability.
But the centerpiece of their aviation is the F-35B Lightning II.
This is the short takeoff vertical landing version, the STOV-VL, And it is absolutely crucial for the Marines because it allows them to operate advanced fifth-generation fighter attack aircraft from amphibious assault ships.
Ships that lack the traditional catapults and arresting gear of a massive aircraft carrier.
This SOVL capability is a game-changer in a contested environment like the Pacific. It allows the Marines to project high-end air superiority without needing large fixed land bases that would be vulnerable to Chinese missile strikes.
They also maintain their own organic aerial refueling and tactical airlift with the KC-130 Hercules, which can refuel the F-35Bs in midair, extending their reach.
Though for strategic airlift moving massive amounts of gear across oceans, they do still rely on the Air Force's Air Mobility Command.
Finally, let's circle back to that flexibility clause. Such other duties as the President or Department of Defense may direct, and look at domestic operations.
The Corps has historically been used in civil disorder situations, reinforcing that idea of them as a highly disciplined federal police force when needed.
We see this with the 1992 Los Angeles riots. President George H.W. Bush invoked the Insurrection Act and deployed 1,500 Marines from the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marine Division.
They served alongside Army forces, integrating them into the response to the violence and civil disorder.
And more recently, the sources cite the 2025 deployment of 700 Marines to Los Angeles, specifically the 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines.
They were deployed under the direction of the administration to integrate with Title 10 forces, meaning forces under presidential authority, tasked with protecting federal personnel, like immigrations, customs enforcement personnel, and federal property during civil disorder.
Civil disorder associated with protests against IC raids. That is a fascinating way that the 18th century flexibility clause is still being applied in the 21st century.
Absolutely.
So what does this all mean? Our deep dive into the USMC reveals a force defined by a relentless need for adaptability.
A total commitment to combined arms integration via the MAD-GTF, and a deep cultural resilience, demonstrated by their survival of repeated political attempts to dissolve them after every major war.
And the modern trajectory is clear and decisive, a strategic pivot toward the sea. The total divestment of main battle tanks, the heavy investment in the F-35B, the ACV, new missile technologies.
It all shows a movement away from being a second army, engaged in ground-centric counterinsurgency toward the maritime domain and island conflicts. They are preparing to deny the enemy control of the seas.
This brings us to the core question of the Corps' future identity, especially when we look at the power of that third clause.
The Marine Corps has a long history of fulfilling such other duties as the President or Department of Defense may direct. From the seizure of Tripoli in 1805 to high-profile domestic deployments protecting federal property in 2025.
So given this unique statutory flexibility, which allows them to pivot from expeditionary force to counterinsurgency force to internal security force, how might this continue to shape the Corps' mission requirements?
Right. If global conflict shifts increasingly between traditional kinetic operations, the fighting in complex civil-military engagements, policing, security, disaster response.
How does this unique dual identity of warfighter and first responder redefine what it means to be a Marine in the next 50 years?
That is something worth mulling over. Is that flexibility the key to their survival or the source of their most controversial assignments? We leave that for you to consider as you reflect on the few, the proud, and the deeply adaptable Marine Corps.
Today we have two very special guests on our program, introducing Lem and Lime.
Hello!
For Starry Lemon Lime Soda.
Thanks for having us.
What is Starry Lemon Lime Soda?
It's a crisp, clear burst of lemon lime flavor, and it's caffeine-free.
Between us, one of you must be a little more important to Starry than the other. Who is it?
We're both important.
So we could just as easily be Starry Lime Lemon Soda.
No, that doesn't sound right.
Ooh, I like it.
So you saying hip-hop could be hop-hip?
Works for me.
Starry Lemon Lime Soda. Starry hits different.
Apartment People, Champion, the trusted name in Columbus Living, brings you The District of Berkshire.
Man, it will be fun to live there, right by Tanger Outlet Malls. Oh my God, great location too, getting to and from Columbus, and a great deal right now.
Free rent until next year. Free rent until next year.
He ain't lying. Move in now, you don't pay rent until next year.
The District at Berkshire, available now at livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com.